KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a membership director, a morning news and public affairs director, and an evening news and public affairs director. The deadline to apply for these three full-time positions has been extended to July 18th by 11:59 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information on these positions and how to apply, just go to kboo.fm/employment today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Jobs with Justice Trivia Night on Saturday, July 20th at 7 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Teams will answer trivia questions about labor and social justice history, politics, pop culture, and other topics. The winning team will receive a prize. The space is ADA accessible and translation, including ASL, provided upon request. Again, that's the Jobs with Justice Trivia Night on Saturday, July 20th at 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Representative Blumenauer has joined with two prominent politicians to push for climate change action.
Labor Secretary Acosta faces calls to resign over the Jeffrey Epstein case.
And a federal appeals court ruled today that President Trump cannot block people on Twitter.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 9th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Early this morning, in the St. John's area of North Portland, the newly formed houseless community known as Jason Barnes Landing was swept. Cleanup crews and police dislocated the community members from the Metro property where they were located. Two people were arrested for, quote, not complying with a lawful order. According to social media, including one supporter of the community, was arrested. Tune in to tomorrow's newscast for a more in-depth update on the Jason Barnes Landing community.
The executive director of a nonprofit organization that supports Latinx youth and families is running for Portland City Council. Carmen Rubio has led the Latino Network since 2009 and has held positions under Multnomah County Commissioner Serena Cruz, Mayor Tom Potter, and Commissioner Nick Fish for over 10 years. Commissioner Amanda Fritz has announced she will not be seeking re-election, and Rubio is a strong contender for the seat. Rubio has cited her background growing up in a low-income migrant family as the driving force behind her decision to run for the position, saying, quote, I'm running for city council because I want to ensure families like mine have opportunities to have a good job and life in this city. Similarly, Sarah Iannarone has announced her candidacy for Portland mayor. Many Portland bicyclists are familiar with Iannarone, as she is a member of the Portland Bureau of Transportation Bicycle Advisory Committee and Budget Advisory Committee. Iannarone previously ran for mayor in 2016, finishing third with 12% of the vote. Iannarone wrote on her campaign website, quote, I believe Portlanders have everything we need to make radical progress today on emergencies like climate chaos, housing affordability, and staggering inequality. A city rigged to work for the most privileged is not resilient, sustainable, or prosperous.
A new shelter for houseless people has officially opened in Portland. The Blackburn Center is located near the intersection of East Burnside and 122nd Avenue. It will focus on housing, health, and employment services. The shelter is owned by Central City Concern and cost about $52 million to develop. The large six-story building has multiple floors that will be dedicated to housing. The bottom two floors are for healthcare services. The center will provide help with a variety of medical issues, including primary care, substance abuse services, and mental health care. The lengths clients will stay at the Blackburn Center depends on their program and usually ranges from around 40 days to about 2 years. The center will house around 175 people, and the clinic will serve about 3,000 patients annually. Dr. Eowyn Reike, services director at the Blackburn Center, said, quote, "Ultimately, what we're about at the Blackburn Center is connection. We're about people. We're about supporting them and helping them feel valued and important so that they can make changes in their lives."
The Portland Police Bureau will undergo some organizational changes effective July 11th. Chief Daniel Outlaw has announced the addition of the Community Services Division that will report directly to the chief. The division will include units that have a citywide approach. This includes the Behavioral Health Unit, a Community Engagement Officer, a Homeless Community Liaison, and a Civilian Community Engagement Specialist position, which has not yet been filled. The Community Services Division will be led by Acting Captain Chuck Lovell. A new Office of Inspector General will also be created in order to enhance the Bureau's internal accountability and auditing functions. Chief Outlaw said, quote, "These divisions will be direct reports to me, and the focus will be on improving continuity of their work product and services, as well as enhancing the Bureau's accountability functions to better meet the community's expectations."
Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has been asked to resign by several high-ranking congressional Democrats over his role in a secret plea deal given to multimillionaire sex offender Jeffrey Epstein while he was a U.S. attorney. Yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tweeted, quote, "Acosta must step down because he engaged in an unconscionable agreement with Epstein that was kept secret from the courageous young victims seeking justice." Epstein was arrested Sunday on charges of sex trafficking involving girls as young as 14. The 2008 plea deal was negotiated by Acosta and resulted in a 13-month work release sentence for Epstein, who would have faced a life sentence if convicted of the federal charges. Acosta has come under fire for keeping the agreement secret from the victims, which a federal judge says is against the law. Pelosi targeted Donald Trump, saying he knew of this plea deal when he appointed him to the cabinet. Trump has defended Acosta, saying he is, quote, "an excellent labor secretary."
A federal appeals court ruled today that President Trump cannot block people on Twitter. The judges in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled unanimously, upholding the previous district court judge's ruling. The Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University had sued the president on behalf of 7 Twitter users who had been blocked by Trump after posting critical messages. Judge Barrington D. Parker wrote, quote, "The First Amendment does not permit a public official who utilizes a social media account for all manner of official purposes to exclude persons from an otherwise open online dialogue because they expressed views with which the official disagrees." The court did not take a stance on banning users from a private account or whether the First Amendment governs speech on social media platforms.
The Affordable Care Act is facing a constitutional challenge from the Trump administration. Public News Service reporter Erica Galletta reports from Colorado.
The Affordable Care Act is set to undergo another stress test this week, and health coverage for more than 500,000 Coloradans and other protections are at stake. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is expected to hear oral arguments today in a case brought by Texas and 19 other Republican-led states. If the appeals court sides with a lower court ruling, the ACA could be repealed. Rachel Wall, a patient advocate with a pre-existing health condition, says she does not want to go back to life before Obamacare.
Before the ACA, when pre-existing conditions could be held against you, I either couldn't get health insurance or I could only get very costly health insurance that really wouldn't cover much of anything that I needed based on pre-existing conditions.
The Affordable Care Act currently prohibits insurance companies from denying or charging more for coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, which can include cancer, diabetes, or even asthma and glaucoma. Plaintiffs in the case argue that the entire ACA is unconstitutional after Congress, as part of the 2017 tax bill, removed a key part of the law that penalized individuals who had not signed up for health insurance.
That was Public News Service reporter Erica Galletta in Colorado.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day transit workers in the Bronx walked off the job in what is referred to as the squeegee strike. These were the days when New York City's public transit was barely organized. 2 of the 3 transit companies in New York City were privately owned with entrenched company unions. Up to this point, transit bosses had successfully crushed every previous strike. Now, six car cleaners at the Jerome Avenue barn had just been fired for refusing management's imposed speed up. Supervisors had replaced their 10-inch squeegees with those that measured 14 inches. They were expected to clean more in a shorter period of time. According to historian Joshua Freeman, author of In Transit, when word spread that the six cleaners had been fired, others downed their tools in protest. They demanded, unsuccessfully, to meet with the shop foreman. After several hours of waiting, they discovered that management had removed their time cards. That's when the two-day walkout began. As many as 70 workers stormed off the job. Pickets went up outside the barn and at the Interborough Rapid Transit headquarters. The regional NLRB office quickly mediated a settlement that forced the IRT to reinstate the discharged workers and strikers, and to answer their grievances. Freeman notes this first strike, though small in scale and brief, was significant. The victory of the squeegee strike immediately built the TWU's authority citywide. It quickly brought several hundred new members into the union. The new dues-paying members provided a financial base for full-time organizers needed to organize New York City's transit. The union would grow rapidly and soon enjoy a number of organizing victories. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The Smithsonian National Museum of American History is looking into acquiring drawings made by children recently released from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which depict the horrific conditions of detention centers. The drawings, made by three children who had been separated from their parents at the border, all show frowning stick figures, people lying on the floor, and cages. In a statement regarding the request for acquisition, a spokesperson for the Smithsonian said, quote, "The museum has a long commitment to telling the complex and complicated history of the United States and documenting that history as it unfolds." Activists have applauded the museum's efforts to preserve the drawings to serve as a reminder for future generations of Americans' complex relationship with immigration. In a tweet last week, Trump wrote, quote, "If the migrants are unhappy with the conditions in the quickly built detention centers, just tell them not to come."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a Montreal street has been renamed to honor Indigenous people, and a Native Food Summit looks at access to traditional foods.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadians across the country recently celebrated National Aboriginal Day, and as Dan Karpinchuk reports, a celebration in Montreal focused on a name change.
Mohawk leaders, the city's mayor, and the head of the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec were on hand to announce the renaming of a street in honor of the local Indigenous population. But it was more than that. Amherst Street had been named after British General Geoffrey Amherst. He was the general who oversaw the surrender of Montreal in September of 1760. Amherst is also accused of knowingly using blankets contaminated with smallpox to put down native rebellions. His name also appears in other parts of Canada, such as Amherst, Nova Scotia, and Amherstburg, Ontario. Ghislain Picard, the head of the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec, says changing the name of Amherst Street in Montreal to Adadagon Street is a significant step towards reconciliation.
Now that Amherst Street has a new name, the spirit of our peoples, the spirit of our ancestors, can now rest in peace.
The city of Montreal pledged several years ago to make the change. It will now be called Adadagon Street and will become official at the end of summer. In Mohawk, Adadagon means brother and sister. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Native Food Summit this summer brought together tribal leaders, advocates, and educators to Billings, Montana to talk about access to traditional Indigenous foods. Kayla DeRoche with Yellowstone Public Radio has more.
Chef Mariah Gladstone stands in front of almost 250 attendees for a live cooking demonstration. Today, Gladstone stuffs a wild green called lamb's quarters into a blender. This version of pesto includes sunflower seeds and wild garlic seeds. A member of the audience steps in as a taste tester.
It's delicious.
It's kind of brassy.
there's a crunch when I bite, which is different in pesto.
This demonstration is part of what's officially known as the Flavors of Home Native Food Sovereignty Summit, which national nonprofits Share Our Strength put together with local partners as part of their No Kid Hungry campaign. Chef Gladstone, who's Cherokee and Blackfoot, defines food sovereignty as the right of people to control their own food systems and to have access to healthy, affordable, culturally appropriate, and sustainable foods. Gladstone is trying to further that mission with IndigiKitchen, a multimedia cooking show that educates people about indigenous foods and recipes.
Native people in Montana and across the country have faced a disconnection from our traditional food systems, and a lot of this has been a systematic erasure and erosion of our ability to obtain traditional foods, and then over time a generational forgetfulness of what qualifies as traditional food and how to prepare those.
Glasson says she strives to reteach the information about traditional foods on IndigiKitchen, and she gets creative, like with the trout and pesto recipe she demonstrates at the summit. The Flavors of Home Native Food Sovereignty Summit isn't the only such event this summer in Billings. The Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council will hold its second annual Food Sovereignty Summit, Roots of a Sovereign Nation, in August. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche, reporting from Billings, Montana.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Baseball fans, sports legends, and celebrities are descending on Cleveland for the All-Star Game. But for the first time, they will not be buying any Cleveland Indians items with the Chief Wahoo's face on it. Mary Sherman reports from Ohio for the Public News Service.
The Indians organization dropped the Chief Wahoo logo from uniforms ahead of the 2019 season, although some fans will surely be donning apparel with the Chief's cartoonish face. Sundance is a member of the Muskogee Tribe and executive director of the Cleveland American Indian Movement. His organization, along with MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred, were instrumental in campaigning to remove the image, despite hesitation from the team. Sundance explains many Native Americans feel the logo is harmful and racist.
I'm happy that Major League Baseball finally took notice of us after half a century, but that's half a century late. It should have been stopped before it started.
For his part, Sundance contends the removal of Chief Wahoo's logo from the field was merely a public relations tactic.
That was Mary Sherman for the Public News Service.
In less than 1 hour, members of Parliament passed two historic amendments that will extend abortion access and same-sex marriage rights to citizens in Northern Ireland. In 2017, the power-sharing executive of Northern Ireland collapsed. Members of Parliament say they have until October 21st to form a new government at Stormont. If they fail to do so, the new regulations will go into effect. Same-sex marriage has been legal in the United Kingdom since 2014, but was never introduced to Northern Ireland due to its opposing devolved government. Currently, abortion in Northern Ireland is illegal in all but the most extreme circumstances. Many politicians have come out in support of the vote, saying that human rights cannot wait for a reformed government. The two frontrunners vying to replace Prime Minister Theresa May, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt, have both said that the issues of same-sex marriage and abortion should be left up to the Northern Ireland Assembly rather than members of Parliament.
Experts consulted by the Federal Trade Commission believe that the government organization is going to take it easy on YouTube, a Google-owned platform that has allegedly been harvesting minors' data and selling it to advertisers for years. Representatives from the Center for Digital Democracy and the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood have called for strict penalties against the tech giant. Digital activists say that by harvesting children's data, the online platforms are violating a 1998 law that prevents companies from tracking data from users under the age of 13 without parental consent. YouTube has been tracking the children's data as a method of fine-tuning ad services that would maximize their time spent on the website, a scheme that would bring in hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue for the company every year. It is believed that the FTC is set to place the responsibility of limiting ads for kids under 13 on content creators rather than YouTube itself. For content creators, limiting ad services would decrease profit. Because of this, critics say that giving them the responsibility of monitoring advertising control is ineffective. Activists say that the interest-based ads are only part of a much greater problem of protecting children from data collection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 66 degrees. Today in history, in 1962, Bob Dylan records his famous song, Blowin' in the Wind, which he claimed to have written in just 10 minutes. The quote of the day is from Bob Dylan's song, Blowin' in the Wind. Dylan sang, quote, "How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?"
Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer has joined with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders to push for an emergency declaration to address the ongoing global climate crisis. The resolution, drafted by Blumenauer and co-sponsored by Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders, is intended to focus attention on the hastening pace of climate change in order to spur action on a national and global scale. The resolution has a chance of passing through the House, where Democrats have a majority. However, it would likely face opposition from Republicans in the Senate, and the chances Trump would then sign it are slim. Supporters of the declaration say time is running out to confront the growing threat of climate change. Blumenauer and Ocasio-Cortez wrote in a letter to fellow lawmakers, quote, "By declaring an emergency, Congress is acknowledging that we need all hands on deck to counter this catastrophe." Blumenauer later added, quote, "The national emergency is not the border, it's the climate."
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, drinking wastewater is not as far-fetched as you might think.
What goes in must come out. On this CurrentCast.
There are plenty of communities that get their water from Lake Michigan, and there's plenty of communities that their wastewater enters Lake Michigan. So it's clearly connected.
That's Sean McElmurray of Wayne State University. He says wastewater includes pollutants such as traces of prescription drugs that people have taken or disposed of. Most wastewater treatment and water purification plants do not have the capacity to remove all of these chemicals, and upgrades would be costly. Since prescription pollutants are making their way into our drinking water, there's widespread agreement that research needs to be done to learn exactly what impact these drugs have on our health and the environment. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cordell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Oregon state regulators are sharply criticizing a federal government environmental analysis that supports the construction of the Jordan Cove LNG terminal. Calgary-based Pembina Pipeline Corporation is proposing building a processing and shipping terminal in Coos Bay to liquefy natural gas and export it to Asia. The terminal would be fed by a 229-mile pipeline running from Klamath County. Friday was the last day for public comment on the federal draft environmental impact statement for the project. The state then submitted a nearly 250-page critique of the analysis. Multiple state agencies said that they identified information gaps, analytical errors, and other deficiencies in the analysis by staff at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The Federal Department of Environmental Quality disputed these statements, saying instead that the project would not result in significant impacts on water resources. The Oregon State Agency comments suggest that they are underwhelmed with the quality and quantity of information provided in the federal government's environmental analysis.
Residents in Los Angeles are concerned after an early warning system failed to warn them of either of the two magnitude earthquakes that struck Southern California last week. The app, Shake Alert LA, was released by the City of LA in late 2018 and was supposed to send an alert to residents for earthquakes of magnitude 5.0 or greater in LA County. Despite the fact that the quake was large enough to splash water out of pools, evacuate businesses, and shake news cameras, government officials say the app functioned properly by not sending a signal. According to Los Angeles Deputy Mayor Jeff Coral, the system only sends an alert if LA County is shaking at an intensity of 5.0 or higher. While the epicenter of the magnitude quake was recorded at 7.1, LA itself shook at a lesser 4.5 magnitude. Public outcry over the inadequate system has led the creators of the app to announce efforts to increase its sensitivity. Many pointed out that only alerting residents of earthquakes in LA County is also ineffective due to its close proximity to the San Andreas fault line.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, wastewater treatment plants in Santiago, Chile, could one day generate as much energy as they use.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you flush your toilet, the water goes down the drain. But before it can be safely discharged back into rivers, lakes, or other waterways, that water must be treated. The process takes a lot of energy. In most places, that energy is costly and creates a lot of carbon pollution. But that's changing in Santiago, Chile. Their utility group Suez is working to make its wastewater treatment plants generate as much power as they use.
By reducing our energy consumption, being more efficient, this is really fighting against the climate change.
Anna Giros is a senior executive VP for Suez, in charge of international activities. She says the company is using sludge, a byproduct of water treatment, to create energy and fertilizer. She says the concept is to transform the wastewater treatment plants into production centers for green resources.
So whatever comes out of these plants, we reuse. We reuse the sludge for agriculture. We reuse the sludge to have energy.
So much energy that the company expects the water treatment plants to be energy self-sufficient and carbon neutral within the next 3 years. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The City of Portland is holding a public forum on the Zenith Energy Terminal growth on Monday, July 15th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at City Hall. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Nick Caleb of the Center for Sustainable Economy.
So on Monday, July 15th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., the City of Portland is going to hold a public forum on the Zenith Oil Terminal expansion that's taking place in Northwest Portland. It's been 145 days as of Monday since Mayor Ted Wheeler came out and said that he opposed that project, and yet we still haven't seen any city action taken place. So we hope that a lot of our colleagues and friends in Portland show up to remind the city that we want them to take action, and hopefully we'll also get some updates from the city on what their plan is to restrict this expansion.
Can you talk a little bit about Zenith's operations? Why is Zenith specifically so important in this situation?
Zenith appears to be a terminal that's expanding for the purposes of primarily shipping tar sands oil from the Alberta tar sands through Portland by rail. And it looks like this is something that's happening because resistance to the tar sands in terms of like Keystone XL pipeline or the Trans Mountain pipeline in Canada has been so successful that investors are looking for other ways to get this dirty product to market. And so Zenith is playing Portland right now to kind of try to demonstrate the viability of the tar sands over the long term. So they've got a modernization project is what they call it, where they're adding capacity to what's called pass-through, where they run more trains through that terminal and move more oil through that terminal. We're not 100% sure exactly where it's going yet, but research is ongoing. And so it's bad for Portland on the climate side because the tar sands are so dirty. They're one of the dirtiest fossil fuels there is. And then it's also dangerous in terms of rail safety because those trains can derail at any time. And oil trains, as we know, are prone to exploding and spilling and harming natural environment. So residents and nature are at risk. So Portland has a history of opposing fossil fuel infrastructure and has passed resolutions against oil trains and laws against the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. So we've already made a lot of decisions. They're sort of operating now on old permits that were grandfathered in before a lot of that happened, but we still think it's really important to raise the pressure on the city and to try to beat this project however we can.
Now, Nick, I know that you live outside of Portland now, at least I believe you do, and this issue actually does impact more than just the Portland metro area. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you do and the organizations and organizers who are trying to put the brakes on this kind of project?
Sure, and I'm actually back in Portland as of last November, but I did move to Southern Oregon for a year to work on resistance against the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas pipeline and export terminal in Southern Oregon. And the importance and how these things are all connected is that the global fossil fuel economy is being outcompeted by renewables sources of energy now. And the fossil fuel industry sort of sees a clock on their industry. It's going away. And they're trying to get as much product to market as fast as possible before things shift. And so in the Pacific Northwest, that means oil, coal, and gas exports have improved dramatically over the past 8 to 10 years. And at one point, I think there were like 28 fossil fuel export terminals proposed all at the same time. And as a movement in the Pacific Northwest, we've been extremely successful at blocking these. So there are two new terminals that are relevant to Portland. One is Zenith, which is already operational and they're expanding. And then another is called Global Partners, which would be sited out in the St. Helens area. And that would also be exporting probably tar sands oil that would come by rail and bring more rail traffic through Portland. So those are, for us at the Center for Sustainable Economy, two of the big campaigns that we're gearing up to fight. But it's important that as residents of Oregon and also people are paying attention to the climate action throughout the Pacific Northwest, that we still track all these other terminals as well and understand their interconnections and basically say no across the board. There's none of these fuels are going to get us to a renewable energy, sustainable future. Gas is not a transition fuel. So whether it's oil, coal, or gas, we need to say no across the board and protect the climate and also protect the safety of residents in these communities.
Nick, for people who are listening right now and they give a damn, what are we asking them to do?
Right now, we want to keep the pressure up at the city of Portland. And we also want to be sending comments to Governor Kate Brown, who potentially has a role to play in this. But for the time being, we've got strong political allies in the city of Portland, and many people elected officials have already issued comments in opposition to this project. And so we want to keep supporting them and keep supporting groups like the Center for Sustainable Economy, Columbia River Keeper, Portland Audubon, 350PX, Oregon Physicians Responsibility for Social Responsibility, and others. So for now, the best thing you can do is either come to that forum on Monday night or send your comments to all five of your city commissioners, letting them know that you oppose Zenith and you want them to take action.
This is just the beginning of the summer. What do you see as coming up on the horizon on these issues for people who want to be active?
Well, I think it depends on what kind of flavor of activism you're into, but we've already seen a tremendous amount of direct action take place over the last 6 months. There was an occupation of the rail facility at Zenith by Extinction Rebellion, and then just a few weeks ago, there was a blockade in front of the city of Portland calling for a climate emergency. And so I think I'm getting the sense that a lot of people in the community want to see strong climate action, and they're not going to tolerate fossil fuel terminals being built. So people are taking direct action, and then also it's changing the conversation among decision makers. So at the city, they're hearing our voices and are starting to make some moves, not as fast as we'd like them, but they're starting to make some moves. At the state, the conversation around fossil fuel infrastructure hasn't really materialized. You mentioned that there was a bill that was passed recently that is going to add some notice requirements for oil trains, and they're going to have to cover a little bit of a worst-case disaster scenario, which is great, but it's not good enough. And we haven't had any of our state legislators even utter the words, no new fossil fuel infrastructure. So I think out of these point source oppositions like Zenith and Global and Jordan Co., we need to be building up toward something at the state level like what we did in the city of Portland, which is to ban new fossil fuel infrastructure across the board so we don't have to keep fighting these individual campaigns.
Nick, people are listening to us right now and they want to know where they can get more information on this. Where are we sending them?
So the easiest way to follow us at the Center for Sustainable Economy is at sustainable-economy.org, or we have a Facebook page, Center for Sustainable Economy, if you search on Facebook, and also we have a Twitter account, CSE Sustainable. So those are the places that we list updates on campaigns and events. And so in addition to the Monday event, we'll be at the Big Float on Saturday advocating against tar sands and oil trains as well. And then we've got a series of other events throughout the summer. And so that's how you can stay with us. And then also following groups like 350 PDX and Columbia River Keeper, Portland Audubon, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and others who also do this climate work, will keep people in contact with the movement and what sorts of events and campaigns are coming up.
Nick Caleb, Center for Sustainable Economy, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Next Monday's public forum about the Zenith Oil Terminal is a key event for many local organizations. We spoke to Solomon Duke, a student activist with the Portland Youth Climate Council, about the event and why it's important.
On Monday, there's a Zenith Community Forum at City Hall, and this is important because it gives the public a way to learn about Zenith, and it also gives, hopefully it will give the city a chance to talk to the public about what they've been doing and the public to voice their opinions and their worries around Zenith.
So can you tell us a little bit about Zenith and what the city's been doing exactly?
Zenith is an Australian energy company that they're expanding their terminal here in Portland, and they are taking tar sand crude oil by rail from Canada, and they're transporting it. First of all, transporting oil by train is much more dangerous than by pipeline, and also tar sand is actually one of the worst forms of fossil fuels on the planet. It pollutes more than any other fossil fuel because of the way it's extracted and the amount of destruction it causes. And currently in Canada, there's actually such a large deposit of this that there's the potential for over twice the amount of carbon dioxide to be emitted from that than the global use in all of history.
Wow. So what has the city of Portland's response been to what Zenith is trying to do?
It's been fairly weak. It's been weaker than we need, at least. Because the Portland Climate Action Plan, part of coming from that was that Portland would oppose all new fossil fuel infrastructure, and that's exactly what Zenith is trying to do right now, and Portland's kind of letting them do it. Mayor Wheeler said that he would do everything he can to stop this from expanding, and he said that 145 days ago and still has done no action.
I see. So you're a part of the Portland Youth Climate Council. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and why you got involved?
The Portland Youth Climate Council is a group of youth that is created in the city of Portland's 100% renewable resolution. And basically, it was created as an advisory board of the city to give a youth perspective on climate issues. And so we're formed from youth from many different schools in Portland. There's people from every school in PPS, but then also some schools that are not in PPS. We advise the city on issues. We're still working on getting more connected with the city, becoming more part of the city, but we meet every Monday at City Hall. Currently, we're working on tree code in Portland. We've worked with on diesel a lot in the past and TriMet, the electrification of TriMet.
So why did you find it important to get involved with the council?
As a youth, I'm terrified of the way this world is going. You know, I don't think anyone should have to worry that the world is dying. You know, no one should have to have that fear. No one should have to think, do I want to have children when I grow up? Will there be a world that they should live in? You know, And I want to make sure that no one ever has to think that. I want to help change the world in a way that it stays healthy, stays livable, and is, you know, just and equitable for people. And currently, that's not the path that we're going. And it's just so terrifying to know that, like, the majority of my life could be lived in a world that I might not want it to live in. And do I really want children to grow up in that world either?
That's important. And also terrifying, like you mentioned. So how can other youth and other and our listeners get involved with what you guys are doing and further the message to Portland City Council? Like, how did you get involved?
There are many ways to get involved. You, if you're youth, contacting the Portland Youth Climate Council, we have a website. Go to the Extinction Rebellion page and look at what they're doing in Portland. They're doing a lot of work right now around Zenith, and you can get contact with that. Sunrise PDX is also a great way for youth to get connected with issues around climate justice in Portland. Showing up on Monday, this coming Monday, if you show up to the Zenith Community Forum, there's many ways to meet people that are working on issues here in Portland there. And there will be a lot of information there, so you can learn a lot.
Awesome. That sounds great. So what do you hope will come from the forum?
I'm hoping that there will be a lot of awareness. Basically, I hope that people will get educated more on what's going on right now around Zenith, the health issues, just like how dangerous it is to have these explosive oil tankers just being transported through these neighborhoods, specifically neighborhoods with people of color and lower income neighborhoods, and just all the health risks that go with that, because a lot of people don't realize just how dangerous it is. Also, just learning about ways that they can stop this, you know, ways that they can get involved, make sure that we can stop the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland altogether, really.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. If you had, you know, any final words for our listeners, what would you say?
There's not a lot of time left before things are going to start changing a lot. They're already starting to change, and it's really important that we don't think of climate change as an issue of the future, but that it's an issue today. It's an issue right now. The IPCC report, you know, we have 11 years really right now, and the clock just keeps ticking. It keeps going down, and it's very important that we act as quickly as possible and really, really take a full U-turn on the direction we're going and towards a much cleaner, much better future.
That was KBOO's Kenzie Beard speaking with Solomon Duke of the Portland Youth Climate Council.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 9th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kenzie Beard, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Leslie McLam. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Randall Rigo. The Interim Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Radio Zine. And then at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's everyone's favorite local gardening show, The Dirt Bag, with host Glenn Andreessen. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On June 29th, in 11th hour fashion, the Oregon legislature approved a bill, HB 2209, with bipartisan support to better prepare Oregon to respond to oil spills from high-hazard trains that carry millions of gallons of crude oil through the state. Today we talk with Peter Cornelison with Friends of the Columbia Gorge about the importance of this bill, which, while it will not stop oil trains from coming through Oregon, at least gives the state some authority to regulate these bomb trains and protect us from their worst-case scenarios. Peter, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara.
Well, I think the last time we had you on the show, we were talking about the fire in the gorge.
Exactly, and Eagle Creek.
Right, and that was a human-set fire by a person who wasn't thinking very clearly. But a lot of people, when we were talking about the fire a couple of years ago, talked about how much more dangerous the oil trains that go through the gorge are than this teenager who threw a firecracker into the Eagle Creek Gorge. So let's talk a little bit about the danger of the trains that are already going through the gorge and what is finally happening to address that danger.
Sure. So in 2015, Washington passed an oil train emergency bill that basically regulates oil trains. Part of the issue with oil trains is the federal government has a lot of the authority to regulate the trains, and the states can only do so much. But Washington recognized the danger, passed an oil train bill in 2015, and on June 3rd of 2016, the Mosier oil train derailment and fire happened. And that was kind of like a wake-up call for everybody. We had been warning people about the dangers of oil trains, but they kind of thought it wasn't going to happen here. But these trains have up to 120 cars of oil. Train cars. Each car carries around 30,000 gallons of oil. If that catches on fire due to a derailment, as we saw in Mosier, the damage can be pretty catastrophic.
And in Mosier, actually, it was only as catastrophic as it was, rather than being like a total cataclysm, because of a fluke in the weather. It wasn't windy that day.
Right. And it was only, I think, three or four cars. If we had half the train, it would have been a huge explosion. As it was, the fire was relatively contained. 42,000 gallons of oil spilled. Actually, a lot of it spilled into their sewer treatment plant, kept it out of the river, although some did make it into the river. But, yeah, that fire could have spread east and engulfed the entire Eastern Gorge, including the Dalles.
And actually probably would have been far more devastating than the Eagle Creek fire.
It very well could have, because there could have been massive property loss and loss of life.
And the other thing about it, well, actually it wasn't in the time of the east winds, unlike the Eagle Creek fire, which was one of the reasons why it almost hit Portland, was because the east winds were blowing through part of that fire.
Yeah.
But if an east wind blows, which it does come pretty regularly through the gorge, then it would have taken the fire probably all the way to Hood River, maybe into all the way to Eagle Creek.
It very well could have, yeah.
So what would have happened, I mean, what was the difference in 2016 between the regulations in Washington State and the regulations in Oregon? And would the Washington State regulations have prevented a similar kind of derailment that happened in Mosier?
Unfortunately, no. The derailment in Mosier was basically the railroad tracks unzipping like a zipper. That's what the federal and state regulators found after they examined the situation. And it was a case of faulty maintenance. Unfortunately, Union Pacific, which runs trains on the Oregon side, does not have as good a safety record as other large railroads when it comes to maintenance. That was, unfortunately, the situation.
So now there's a bill that's just passed through the Oregon legislature, and I want to take a little sidebar in a moment to talk about how this bill almost didn't get even through the Senate.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
So this bill that has been voted on by both houses, which is House Bill 2209, and is waiting on Governor Brown's desk for a signature, how does this bill strengthen Oregon regulations so that it, how might it prevent future derailments, even though it certainly wouldn't prevent a track derailment, it sounds like.
Sure. So there's three basic parts to the bill. The first one is that it requires the railroads to come up with an emergency oil spill response plan and submit that to Oregon DEQ for review and approval. Right now, they may or may not have a plan. Now it's codified into law. They must. The second thing is the railroads are being assessed a fee that will go into spill response and training. When one of these trains derails, it's a massive event. It requires a command center and multiple agencies get involved. And they need to do what's called tabletop exercises to practice that. And this bill creates a fund to do that through fees on the railroads.
Now, I want to check for a second, because my recollection with the moisture spill, it sounds like all these things would have actually made the moisture spill easier to deal with if they had been prepared. But I recall the guy who was in charge of fixing things was, I think, in Canyonville or something. He was way down in Southern Oregon and had to drive back up, not only to Portland, but then out to Mosier and deal with all the traffic, the traffic jam on 84. And it just seemed like they weren't really well prepared. I mean, this train is leaving from North Dakota and going through the Northwest and then going up to Tacoma where we're supposed to go. Why is this guy who's their maintenance person down in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, I don't know about that. The thing that was fortunate is they had done one of these tabletop exercises about a month before in the Dalles. So all the agencies had come together and practiced. And so they were fairly together. But as you say, the traffic was horrendous. 84 was backed up. Traffic across the Hood River Bridge was backed up. Highway 14. So there's virtually no way to get to the scene. And the first responders from Portland that had a special kind of foam that's necessary to fight oil train fires were not able to reach Mosier for hours.
And they were stationed out by the Portland airport, I understand.
Right. They use that foam for airport fires.
Now, is this bill going to address all those kinds of logistical nightmares that we saw 3 years ago in Mosier?
It's going to help, but there's no real way to uncrowd a crowded freeway. The gorge is a narrow, kind of tight place in spots, and when the traffic backs up, there's nothing you can really do aside from flying with a helicopter.
Well, it sounds like the only thing we can do is stop oil trains from going through the gorge, but this bill doesn't do that.
This bill, unfortunately, doesn't do that. The third thing the bill does is requires railroads to prove they can pay for a worst case oil spill. And no, we can't stop oil trains at the state level. At the federal level, it's possible. It's kind of like if you had an unsafe car or truck, would you allow it on the road? And yet the federal government is allowing these oil trains to continue.
Well, another side, because I think in all the literature that you sent me late last night, there's talk. I mean, there seems to be three areas of making trains safer. And one has to do with changing the brakes. One has to do with having, it's kind of like almost like smart cars where they can sense things and override the idiocy of a engineer who's asleep or not in the car, the train at all, like my Contique. And then the other one is improving the oil tank cars themselves so that they're more impervious to puncture.
That's
so
right.
My understanding, though, is the cars in the Mosier train were not the old, the 1110s or whatever. It was the later ones that are supposed to be safer, and they punctured. So is there such a thing as a safe oil tanker?
There really isn't. They're sort of unsafe at any speed. When you have that much weight in any kind of a steel structure, there's a lot of kinetic energy, and any kind of an impact on the ground can rupture the tank. Yeah, so the Obama administration, so these oil train derailments and fires started happening around 2013 with the giant fire in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, which killed 47 people and a few more since then because they've committed suicide.
They actually destroyed the town.
It leveled half the town, and the rest of the buildings that were left had to be torn down because they were filled with oil. The oil drained into the city sewer system on fire, and so the fire department was having to fight that. 200,000 gallons flowed into their river.
Actually, let's just—I mean, for people who forget that, because now it's what 6 years ago, and memories are short.
Yeah.
But how did that derailment happen?
Basically, the train was parked out of town, up on a hill, and the engineer thought he had set the brakes, but he didn't, not well enough, and it rolled back downhill uncontrolled, and when it reached the town, it derailed and exploded in this massive fireball. So that was truly a worst case situation. About half the train was involved.
Now, where was the engineer? Was he on the train, or was he in some hotel somewhere sleeping?
I think it was away.
So is there any regulations about now about railroad engineers needing to stay with the train at all time, or at least being somebody on board a train, even if it's parked overnight?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but there's a couple things to go back to your earlier question. They have made the train cars safer. They're thicker, and the flanges, the seals are not supposed to tear off when they receive an impact. And the older cars, the DOT 111 cars, which are basically tin cans, are being retrofitted, and new cars are coming online.
And like retrofitting those tankers, is that kind of like retrofitting the single shell tanks at Hanford? I mean, it just makes me wonder if these things really leak. I mean, how do you make them not leak?
It's not going to be as good as a new car. And even, oil should not be transported by rail cars. That's the long and the short of it. The other requirement that was supposed to be happening was, as you said, electronically controlled pneumatic braking. And that rule was put in place, but the Trump administration threw it out and is not requiring it, claiming it's going to cost the railroads too much money.
Now, what's the difference between that kind of braking and the traditional braking the trains have?
So the current braking is air brakes, which were invented by George Westinghouse in 1868. That technology has basically not changed since then. And the problem is that the engineer signals that the brakes need to be engaged, and that signal has to travel through each rail car. So it's slower than electronic means. With this new braking system, there's an electronic signal that runs through the entire train, so the brakes can be applied at the same time rather than delayed. It also... If the signal goes out, the rear cars can be slowed down first, which helps brake the train further. So these new improvements were going to cost a lot, and so the Trump administration, in their wisdom, decided to ditch them. So that's not required. The other aspect, getting back to personnel, is that oil trains previously have been required to have two personnel on the train, an engineer and a conductor. That has been rescinded, and now there's only the engineer on the train.
You know, actually, this might be off the subject, but I recall a number of years ago at a crossing I spent a lot of time waiting at Milwaukee and Clinton, where it's a Union Pacific crossing. And there was a while back in the 80s, I think, when there was a sign up saying trains may not have any people, may not have any engineers. This train is running on its own.
Yeah.
And I mean, are they still doing that? I mean, they don't have that sign up anymore, but it makes me really worry how many of these trains that go by actually are not controlled by human beings. Like driverless trains.
Autonomous trains, I don't know. Yeah, I as far as I know, they still require a conductor, but they cost cutting is, if they don't make enough money already, take as many people off of the job as possible.
Well, today we're talking about oil trains and their dangers and how they may be at least regulated to some degree here in Oregon. You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking with Peter Cornelison, who's with Friends of the Columbia Gorge.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Transpositive with Emma and Nicolette. Preference will be back in 2 weeks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Voices of a People's History celebrates diverse movement leaders by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Coley Neighborhood Farmers Market. This is a weekly event at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. The market features local farmers and businesses, and this Thursday, July 11th, there will also be face painting and music by Pete Krebs. Again, that's the Coley Neighborhood Farmers Market, Thursday, July 11th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side.